Hi, welcome to the very first episode of New Books in British Studies, the podcast channel where we interview authors working in the exciting and diverse fields that make up British Studies. I'm your host, Christina Fryer. Today we're talking with Caroline Shaw, author of the timely new book, Britannia's Embrace, Modern Humanitarianism and the Imperial Origins of Refugee Relief, published by Oxford University Press in 2015. Britannia's Embrace traces how, in Britain, a moral commitment to providing refuge developed during the long 19th century, leading to a dramatic expansion of the refugee category. This moral commitment remains strong even in the face of limited resources and political obstacles. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hello and welcome to the first episode of New Books in British Studies. I am your host, Christina Fryer, and today we are speaking with Caroline Shaw, assistant professor at Bates. And we're talking about her new book, Britannia's Embrace, Modern Humanitarianism and the Imperial Origins of Refugee Relief, published with Oxford University Press in 2015. Caroline, welcome to New Books in British History.
Thanks.
Or British Studies, I should say.
Thanks, and thanks for welcoming me on.
So let's start with the sort of general questions that we ask. So first, what led you to become a historian?
Good question. Like in some ways, I've always been vetting other careers against becoming a historian, but a long fascination with the past and a deep desire to imagine what life was like in different moments in different places, probably, but more particularly my undergraduate career, certainly at Hopkins. I went in as knowing that I would be a history major, but the questions that I was asked in my version of the modern European history class that I took my freshman year asked, Britain was the closest to what it's going to be to a 19th century revolution in 1819, but it didn't happen. And I was hooked. I kept working on that puzzle, which I learned subsequently that many people had been working on for over 100 years, probably, at that point. I was hooked in trying to figure that out. And really, from there, that got me further into history as a graduate career option, and probably British history more particularly as well.
So then tell us how you came to this specific project about refugees.
Well, by the time I was at Berkeley, I was still, in a way, thinking with the comparative question of how Britain reacted to foreign revolutions. And I was quite interested in the international news. I went into my pre-dissertation research summer trying to figure out what that topic would look like, sort of sniffing around 1848 and British reactions to an array of conflicts at that point. And I was very interested in trying to figure out how to measure that. How do we measure their response? What does it mean? What does it do? I was also interested in and didn't quite know how they connected at that point, humanitarianism and more broadly moral commitments, the storytelling, and that storytelling is elements both in the international news and in humanitarianism. And I found as I was sifting through the potential archives that refugees were all over the place and we didn't know anything about them.
Right.
The story goes, we know Marx was in Britain, we know Bolivar, we know all of these various 19th century greats from elsewhere were in Britain at various points, as well as certainly many, many unknown revolutionaries and others forced to flee their countries as well. So what was that history? And the deeper I got into that, the more I wanted to tell that story.
That sounds like a fascinating way and sort of an actually not intuitive way of getting to the project, which I think we actually see in the very creative way that you have approached the project in the book. So, as I see it, Britannia's Embrace traces two things. First, the emergence of the category of the refugee, which you argue over the course of the time period that you're focusing on, becomes potentially universal in scope. The second thing that you're tracing is the moral commitment to providing refuge for persecuted foreigners. So could you tell us what you mean by moral commitment? It's a pretty critical concept throughout the book.
Right, certainly. And I would start just by backtracking a moment to say that I think your two tracks in the book, I think, are absolutely fair, the right ones that I'm tracing. The two are interconnected.
Of course.
And very much that the much of that, what I'm going to explain as that moral commitment, comes out of their ability to see it through. So how that moral commitment, their ability to see it through, and with that, the potential universalization of the category itself. That if they had started out with limited means, they might have remained at a definition of refugee that was more or less tied to Protestant, as it was for much of the 18th century, through the much of the 18th century. So by moral commitment, what I mean is an interest, and that interest is diffuse, but also articulated at the national level by policymakers, as well as people lobbying the government. Commitment to provide refuge and commitment to help those who are persecuted overseas. And by overseas, in this case, my refugees are all foreign. They're not coming from within the British Empire, but from other conflicts further afield. And that moral commitment, I argue here, it starts in with a sense of raison d'etre. There is a reason for it. And I think that while that immediate reason of the Protestant nation trying to take in Protestant refugees that you get in the 18th century does drop away, that moral commitment is always tied to Britain's notions of themselves. That going into the 19th century, they continue to find themselves committed and recommitted in an increasingly broad sense to people who can have claims as refugees, who can ascribe themselves to this broadening category, because these people in this category matches what Britain sees as, or Britain see as their new raison d'etre, and raison d'etre that being the creation of a liberal modernity and an attempt to instantiate what that looks like for them in that moment,
right,
across the globe.
Right. And I wanted to sort of backtrack a little bit. As you're tracking this development of a moral commitment to refuge in Britain, I think the question also is raised, and you talk about this in the introduction, of why is this a particularly British story? I think there's a claim here that that Britain has a particularly important role to play in the creation of this category. Could you explain why Britain and why not other places like France or the United States?
Certainly. And you know, there are two reasons, really. One is sort of a broad rhetorical reason, and one is just sort of pragmatic.
Right.
In a pragmatic sense, Britain is the one place that remains open to foreigners consistently throughout. So while, for instance, in the 1790s, refugees, especially from Eastern Europe, from Poland more particularly, will make their way to France, revolutionary France, that stops, that shifts with every French government, right? So there isn't a consistency there. With the United States, there is the potential for consistency. Once you start talking about refugee slaves, of course, that looks very different pre-Civil War. With Britain, again, it's more consistent. And conceptually, vis-a-vis the United States, more particularly the United States, the language of the asylum for mankind, as Tom Paine's term for it in the 18th century, very quickly becomes one wrapped up in immigration more writ large, in a way that doesn't classically distinguish, since it is a country of immigration, it doesn't distinguish between refugee, immigrant for other reason, as closely as the British do.
Interesting.
So the way that the British create it is actually in a slightly more narrow sense, but at the same time more specific to the refugee category. And again, more consistent than, for instance, the French, the Dutch, the Swiss, etc.
Interesting. Thank you for that. So as the book has eight chapters plus an introduction and conclusion, and there are really three phases that you are tracking here. First, the creation and development of this moral commitment. The second phase is the implementation of refugee relief as really driven by this moral commitment, and also the attendant challenges to implementing refugee relief. And then finally, the legal enshrinement of a right of refuge, or right to refuge, I should say, that, as you note, at the same time that this right is being legally enshrined, the category of who qualifies to be a refugee is actually shrinking. So if we can, let's start with this sort of first phase, the creation of the moral commitment to providing refuge. And you locate that first in the shift in what you refer to as confessional logic, or the elimination of the confessional logic. Can you take us through basically what's happening in chapter one, where you move from the Huguenots all the way up to the French Revolution?
Certainly. And actually, if I could just flag something before.
Absolutely.
Those listeners who I know are going to say, wait, a right to refuge? There isn't a right to refuge. There now is a right to seek asylum, but not a right to receive it.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, one of the things that I'm sure we'll wind up highlighting, but there is actually a more strictly articulated right to at various moments in British history in the 19th century, even though certainly now international law, there is no explicit right to this. So just to
right.
wrap that before we go.
Absolutely. Thanks for that. I'll make sure that we come back to that issue.
But back to the 18th century. Yeah. So what happens, the shift to the Huguenots, as I mentioned briefly before, you know, the Huguenots are the original refugees. They are French Protestants. They bring the term refugee, though they've been coming to Britain as to other Protestant European countries for a couple centuries by this point, when persecuted in Catholic countries. They bring the term with them after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in 1685. So it's not as though they're the first people who would broadly could be ascribed to the refugee category, but this is the first instance in which we really have that label. Britain being a Protestant nation, and one in the throes of its own, or just following its own civil war, and now about to be in the throes of its glorious revolution, these Huguenots become very quickly wrapped up in that Protestant raison d'etre, a way of seeking a litmus test in terms of commitment to a Protestantism, as opposed to a Catholicism, which many people at the time of the revocation, James is already on the throne, and he is known to be a Catholic, and the concern is certainly that he is very much indebted to Louis the 14th of France. So what his reaction is going to be, and what the state's reaction more broadly is going to be to these Huguenots, becomes a major thing. So providing relief in this respect, which certainly is going on at the state level as well as at the parish and individual levels through the Protestant churches of within the United within Britain, is really part of that. That continues in a significant way throughout much of the 18th century. The last Huguenots actually to be on the treasury rolls are on into the 19th century. So that legacy continues on. By the time we get to the French Revolution, though, this has to shift. The people starting to come over are actually Catholic.
Right.
Right. So while one could argue that Britain is less hyper-confessional, certainly by the end of the 18th century, there are arguments afoot about trying to scale back on the Catholic disabilities already, but they are still very popularly anti-Catholic, especially once you get away from a certain London or philanthropic elite. But this campaign to help both the emigre priests fleeing the revolutionary government in France, as well as the lay people, really takes on a national bent very quickly in the early 1790s. And the commitment there is still a commitment to state, but it's a commitment to the state's aims to withstand revolution itself. So it switches from that confessional to the ideological,
right,
to the political, to a new existential threat that dovetails well with an argument increasing throughout the 18th century, and certainly not sort of new to this moment, about the need for new philanthropies, new charitable organizations that dovetail with this raison d'etre and a need for helping these particular individuals.
Right. And you also point out in this chapter, particularly as we're moving into the French Revolution, and with these emigre priests, that there's also an enormous amount of concern about making sure that the people who are claiming refuge, you know, for some people, it's bad enough that they're Catholic, but there's concern that they could be bringing radical ideas with them, that they could be Jacobin spies. Can you talk a little bit about the vetting processes that emerged during this period? Because I think that idea of vetting also is very much tied to refugee relief once we move past the Huguenots.
Right, absolutely. And the vetting process is by this point and will remain into the 19th century very heavily tied on other foreign nationals. So some of the bishops, some of the higher-ups in the Catholic establishment from France who are in London, and it's certainly members of the French aristocracy, help initially, especially by vetting who's there. Okay, well, here's how we know who they are. We don't necessarily know them personally, but somebody else knows them. Again, a very a formalized, informal network of trying to vet people. There's also, you know, certainly there's a hefty dose of spying, especially not as I don't do as much of this with the Huguenot, with the emigres in the 1790s, but certainly later on, the Home Office is very concerned of just making sure, okay, these are, you know, these might be revolutionaries by the later 19th century. We're talking anarchists, we're talking earlier than that, the democratic socialists coming from across Europe. They might be radical, but they're not doing anything. So the vetting process happens at that level as well as certainly at the higher up. And a lot of the relief efforts are doled out via the Treasury in the 1790s, but they go, again, as they did with the Huguenots, through established means such that the people handing them out are sort of part of this process all along and vetting it. With the emigres more particularly, and they're the last to be forced into this category of serving the British state. Part of that sense of existential threat, that the lay emigres are forced, the men are increasingly forced into the army throughout the 1790s to go back to France to fight that effort. And relief is for their whole families in many ways tied to that. So that vetting process happens there as well. Or are you really going to go fight? And it's really dire circumstances because if they were captured in France, they would be pretty much summarily executed.
Right. Well. And you notice, or you note, I should say, that this happens, there's a particularly dire instance of this at Quiberon, where an enormous number of people are summarily executed as a result. And if I'm remembering correctly, you argue that it's sort of after that moment that the idea of this sort of quid pro quo relief or refuge, I should say, for military service really starts to fall off.
Yeah, that it becomes really hard to make that a necessity. And certainly, as I mentioned, there's always been this more humanitarian element, more philanthropically driven point too, that has tied itself with the state and has worked together. And I think that element, the purely philanthropic, really takes over. That said, people who do serve the British throughout the Napoleonic Wars, etc., do get particular pensions that are separate, though equivalent to the refugee relief that happens through other means, including the state. So that service to the British state in that respect drops off slowly, but this is really, I think, the major turning point.
Right. So in chapter two, you sort of move into the 19th century more fully, basically sort of picking up after the Congress of Vienna. And one of the things that you note is that refuge in certain ways is almost kind of a consolation prize or an acknowledgement that Britain cannot be actively intervening in all of these particularly continental revolutions or continental conflicts. And so foreign intervention is not really a possibility, and so refuge sort of comes in to be the sort of act of humanitarianism that Britain can do. Can you walk us through this development?
Yeah, well, so the Congress of Vienna brought with it, as I'm sure many in the audience know, you know, major defeat for a nascent liberal cause. It's the conservatives that are returned to the thrones. The Congress of Vienna also brought with it the first international debates for ending the international slave trade,
right,
as well. Both of these brought, you know, a triumph on the one hand and a, you know, sort of a loss on the other, for, you know, brought with it new commitments. So certainly the British couldn't intervene overseas and didn't want necessarily to intervene, certainly the Foreign Office, as Davide Rodogno has recently looked at. You know, the Foreign Office doesn't really want to intervene in a lot of affairs, including that in Greece, which they wind up getting involved with in the later 1820s. But though they can't do that, though they can't see sort of that cause of liberty, that cause of a fight against despotism, as they see it, eliminated, they still can help the people who are fleeing it. Right? So this is where that turn to refuge comes in. And it becomes something of that consolation prize. It also becomes something of a placeholder, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we can't intervene now, but through refugees, that sort of ultimate look at an alternate future, maybe one day we can see this coming through. So our friendship, our help with refugees, which you see both, you know, to some degree with the state, but more particularly with emerging liberal and radical associations trying to take on these mantles of continental freedom, right, European freedom, and seeing this through refugees. And through the aid of refugees. In terms of the other track of this, that the Congress of Vienna brought with it, the discussions of the end of slavery, international slave trade, I should say, that with that comes the understanding that you are going to wind up with ships that are actually trafficking illegal slaves.
Mm-hmm.
So the question and the obligation that gets incurred is one here, actually, that's done by treaty, right? So by all these slave trade, anti-slave trade treaties, the question of what happens with those people who are caught up in it, who need to be freed somewhere and can't realistically be brought back home, as though the British sort of can figure this out. More particularly, it needs to be figured out where refuge can happen. So that's more treaty obligated refuge. Again, that's by these multiple bilateral treaties that happen following the Congress of Vienna about the slave trade. And then the other more diffuse, sort of romanticized loss of liberty on the continent in terms of the continental refugees.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things you highlight in this chapter is that you suggest that the base of support for providing refugee relief is actually broader than we have previously understood. You suggest that this is actually a cross class, a broad base of support. Can you talk about what the previous understanding in the literature was, and how you were able to demonstrate this broader base of support?
Sure. Previously in the literature, especially for the earlier emigres, you tend to talk about the elite, and certainly people on the orders of Fanny Burney, people who have these connections, and Edmund Burke, people who are, you know, very much at that upper echelon. What you see increasingly is an involvement among a newer middle class, and especially also at least not the broad working class, but in a sort of an elite part of the working class, at the very least, claiming and espousing that their involvement with refugees is significant, and making a claim on that is both seeking common cause with many of the refugees, but also claiming their share in this national burden, the international humanitarian burden as well. And the way I draw this out and look at it is often through the the relief lists of the various societies, every single refugee group, and in a way you could say every disaster too overseas, mm-hmm. but certainly all of the refugees coming through, be that the fugitive slaves who don't always come through, they're often in Canada, be that the more democratic Polish nationalists later on, be that the French, be that the Italians, etc., have their relief societies. And these relief societies are a who's who of, certainly of high society, but then also of a broader class base as well. So some of them you see as more middle class oriented, certainly the ones claiming to be working class look broadly like they're drawing on a Chartist elite, but B, also that they're going into these communities and trying to drum up some support more broadly. So one example of that, in the 1851 attempt to help the Hungarian, the Poles who had been helping the Hungarian cause, who tended to be more democratic than the elite Hungarians coming through. And there was a question as to whether or not the government and certainly the local elite were going to help them in their refuge or just essentially ship them over to America, which is what happened to many of them. But those who are trying to help them, claiming a working class affiliation, will have relief scrolls that say, well, said factory, said place of work contributed X amount together, right? So you'll see that grouping together, mm-hmm. assuming that, you know, they're all contributing a little bit or even just, you know, a shilling, several of them together to then contribute to what in this particular case was the shilling for European freedom, shilling subscription to European freedom. And they get their certificate
right.
that was touted in the various various radical newspapers as, you know, sort of the thing to have.
Well, that's fascinating, and I can basically imagine, you know, at the workplace, at the factory, people sort of pressing their case that this is a cause that we really should support, and sort of gathering up a collection. There's something really evocative about that. There's so much rich material throughout this book, but I think chapter 3 for me is particularly fascinating. And here you're tracking the refugee narrative genre, both what it actually looks like and the way that it sort of creates almost a standard template for how people understand refugees, and at the same time how that then mobilizes or how that those narratives are used to mobilize actual campaigns to provide relief. And here we're shifting into phase 2, which is sort of the implementation of refugee relief, the actual on-the-ground providing of aid, and the challenges that approach it. So could you talk us through the refugee narrative genre and what it looks like, and then we can move into how that helped mobilize campaigns?
Sure, certainly. As a genre, I should say first that this is something that I've seen echoed in newspaper accounts, these various philanthropic societies, the stories that especially elite refugees who can speak English speak for themselves, as well as those speaking for them, as is often the case in the various meetings that are gotten up in their relief. So this is what I'm drawing on when I look at this genre that really emerges in the early half of the first half of the 19th century. The genre is remarkable in that its task is to tell a couple of stories. One, it's a story about why the British should care.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's to make those claims about persecution of the innocent, that these people are innocent, even if they're fighting, that they're very much they're doing what they need to do. They're heroic, unlike what we will later think about as refugees is tending to be gendered a female and tending to be passive victims. These are fighters, right? And this becomes part of this genre. The innocent part of this as well is that there's a lot of suffering going on at home, right? So their families are very much suffering. Again, this is this narrative of suffering and attempting to overcome persecution. So this is, you know, so why do we care? What are these refugees doing to try to change their situations? Part of this narrative. And why the British in particular ought to be the ones to come to their aid, right? So there's that pitch too. And that pitch is done in a couple of ways, that these refugees are doing all that they can in their exile. They love their British hosts. Yes, the classic, of course they have to say something like this. Mm-hmm. to their would-be hosts and supporters, and that they're doing all that they can to work in exile despite their suffering. So there's an element of hard work that's something of a that becomes more important later, but that is an undercurrent in all of these categories, that whatever their class station, that they've fallen. And that they're meant to pity them, of course, and to identify with them, and also to see that they're doing everything that they can.
Mm-hmm.
And that this British help, the British to the rescue, is that sort of last portion of these refugee narratives, is the opening for those to then give and help to help to provide this relief.
And I imagine that this claim that that they are hardworking is also particularly important in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, as the language about who deserves relief more broadly is really shifting to this conversation about the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. It certainly will not do if refugees arrive and are quickly becoming quote unquote undeserving poor because they, they aren't working or because they're becoming a drain on the state.
Right. And I think that's huge in the refugee narrative to articulate. It's even more important to be able to articulate that as a way of saying, as part of saying, that look, no, we're refugees, or these are, depending on the construction of the narrative,
mm-hmm.
who have been persecuted. We're not immigrants, right?
Right.
British law in this moment doesn't distinguish between anybody coming in. It's not vetting who can come in. The refugee as a category is this category created culturally in these moments, distinguished from those people who are otherwise seeming to be long-term immigrants. That's in part just to foreshadow, that's the irony that I pick up in the next chapter, that of course many of these people constructing those, who are refugees, who have been persecuted and flee for those reasons, have to look for a long durée of exile,
right.
Have to essentially become immigrants themselves, even though this refugee narrative so closely tracks the ways in which they aren't your classic, just migrant or foreigner of any sort.
So how did these refugee relief campaigns work? So once we have a certain level of moral outrage being ginned up by these refugee narratives, what does relief actually look like on the ground in Britain in particular? And then, of course, in the remaining chapters of this section, we'll shift to abroad.
Right. In Britain, it takes a form fairly quickly of protest meetings, protest against the evil overseas. It becomes quickly, so meetings become concerts, they become all these other things as well as time goes on, but initially that public demonstration of outrage at what's going on. That often very much comes along with sort of two things. One, on the ground, it comes along with immediate relief and sort of collecting of or promising the getting up of a committee to help with the refugees themselves if they're there. Or it also comes with a dissemination of the proceedings of these meetings in the various news outlets across the British Isles. So in a way, though this might be happening in Southampton or in Liverpool or London, that this news gets carried elsewhere, and the hope then is that more people actually contribute as well. What happens, and let me walk you through a particular case to go back to the Poles who had been supporting the Hungarian cause.
Absolutely.
In Liverpool, because I think this also gets to some of the divisiveness of some of these campaigns as well. It's not to say that everybody might be abstractly on board with an expanding refugee category, but not exactly with how they should be provided with relief. So the Poles come in, they arrive in 1851, and the question is whether or not they ought to be able to stay there. So what happens is twofold. One, local officials go on board the ships and talk to them, and then again in the barracks where they stay on shore, say, look, we'll provide you with passage to America. Continue on. And they see this as the is actually sort of the celebration. You know, this is British Refuge too, right? It's transportation, right? They don't see any problems with this. This is, though, the moment in which especially Chartist outlets see a problem in this and want to make this more of a political gambit for the poor Poles, the more radical Democrats who are not being treated as well as the elite refugees. And what they do is get up a campaign to disseminate groups of refugees to various towns, especially throughout the north of England, wherein in each town the refugees would be provided with work and support and people essentially sponsoring them in a way very similar to what we, you know, we can think about now in the way that refugees are often dispersed throughout various places.
Right.
And I think the point I would just add to that quickly is that thanks to work like that of Laura Tabili's new work on the provinces, she particularly looks at, if memory serves, Sheffield and North Shields, so it's a northern area, that she finds that the makeup, the social makeup of these areas is much more cosmopolitan than we would ever assume. So when we think of the Britons and the people who are sort of reaching out and welcoming refugees in, we have to have a picture of a world in which, yes, these people are coming from elsewhere. Yes, they might seem more foreign at the moment, but there is also that engagement, not only with what's happening outside, but outside Britain, but also with different populations within, a much more cosmopolitan center.
Right. So in chapters 4 and 5, you move into sort of the imperial portion of refugee relief. And in this, the inaugural episode of New Books in British Studies, I think for me, one of the things that's always so fascinating about Britain, and particularly Britain as an imperial power, is just how tiny the country itself actually is. And this is something that I always emphasize to students, just how tiny Britain is. And we see this issue of Britain's small size emerging when it comes to refugee relief. There simply is not remotely enough space, enough resources. There's certainly not enough work for all of the refugees streaming in from the continent, in particular, or fugitive slaves, I should say, to be resettled in Britain proper. So the empire, or not simply the formal empire, but also the informal empire, places where Britain has influence, become critical valves of basically migration out of Britain for many of these refugees. So can you walk us through this idea that you first talk about in Chapter 4 of overseas refuge, which seems to sustain the moral commitment to refuge by making it, in fact, feasible?
Right. And this is going back to the sort of earlier point that we were talking about in terms of the moral commitment and the categories
right.
being tied very much to the resources by which they can provide refuge, which is certainly resources within the British Isles, but then critically outside as well. And this move to empire, to a transmigration approach to refuge, goes back to the quote unquote lower class Protestants coming in from Salzburg and yeah, the Salzburger and the Palatine. Mm-hmm. Areas in the early 18th century when they were essentially sort of encouraged quickly to go out to the colonies at that point, to the Americas. This continues and becomes even more of a thing. And I think the first point that I would want to highlight with this turn towards empire, the use of empire and informal empire in this respect, is that it's steeped in a number of things, but primarily often a real fear that they can't accommodate people in Britain. Not always the reality that they can't, but from the time of the emigres, this fear that anti-Catholicism is really going to get going, fears with the Huguenots lasted through the 1830s, you know, and a little bit beyond as well, as to what the competition with various workers in Britain looked like. So the fears of competition, in some cases, of course, real competition, and then fear of numbers, if not always actual numbers, really makes this overseas outlet viable. So what we're talking about are, you know, the Americas, even after independence, Canada certainly continuing. We're talking a lot about both fugitive slaves and for liberated Africans, talking about Sierra Leone. For American fugitive slaves, at least in one high-profile case, we're talking about Liberia.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're talking East Africa, we're talking Palestine, et cetera. And the list goes on and continues to expand in the 20th century as well. But these places are both places where the refuge providers, as well as many of the refugees themselves, to think that they're going to have a better chance. And this is very much tied to the British domestic narrative about a social safety valve too. So, you know, there is a domestic equivalent to that vis-a-vis the British in the 19th century as well, looking for that safety valve in the empire. So they're meant to be able to set up for themselves to become, in this true quintessential liberal fashion, to become self-sustaining, self-regulating groups. The people who are targeted for this transmigration is broad. It's often, very often, about race and race and increasingly later in the 19th century, an attempt to be about religion too, going back to and going to the Jews as well. But it's about class, about politics. And, you know, as I said, about religion, so the emigre priests, they're encouraged to go to Quebec because that's a Catholic place, right? They don't wind up going because a concordat with the Pope happens soon enough that they're able to go back to France. But this is a way, again, that long-term refuge seems more feasible and becomes celebrated, in part because of missionary narratives in places like Sierra Leone that tout the successes, mm-hmm. despite some very obvious failures in Sierra Leone. But that really enable it to seem like this is working, and enable it to for the people at home to assume that this is really British refuge, and this is something that works seamlessly enough that we can celebrate what we're doing, and you know certainly can continue it.
Mm-hmm. And it seems, in fact, that the idea for or what Britons at home take away is that it's working so seamlessly, in fact, that it is worth encouraging metropolitan intervention in instances where it becomes publicly known that it is not working. And you have two cases here in Chapter 5 of Malta and a case in Canada in which there's pretty significant metropolitan intervention into the affairs of these colonies in order to preserve the idea, at least, that refuge, overseas refuge, is possible. Do you want to pick one of those, whichever one is most interesting to you today?
I love both of them. and there was a third that I actually took out of the book. I hope to come back to it at some point later, not in the interview and in writing. I'll pick the Anderson case.
Okay.
I think he has, reach and speaks as well to this question of the long durée of exile as well, given what happens to him. So Anderson is an American fugitive slave. He flees Missouri in 1854. As the fugitive slave law of the United States is in place, so anybody just fleeing to the north is not safe from recapture and return. He manages to flee to Canada, but en route, he kills a man. He kills a slave catcher. Now, this is the test case that the abolitionists in particular have been waiting for, to test both Britain's commitment to abolitionism, to an international abolitionism, and in a way to test this power of refuge itself. This comes on the heels of Harriet Beecher Stowe's call to certainly an American public, but a British public as well. The book was quite popular there and had many spin-offs, that the fugitive slave who defends himself, in her case, George Harris, fictional George Harris, becomes the real John Anderson.
Right.
And she makes the claim that this person is no different than a Hungarian nobleman. And part of this broad hat refuge in the refugee category that it is meant to be potentially universal. Right. So here's the test case. Is it universal? What does it do? In one of the test cases. So Anderson lives in Canada for some time, undetected. but he is detected in 1860. And the question becomes whether or not he can be extradited to the United States to face trial. This becomes a big to-do on both sides of the Atlantic because Canada, you know, for three reasons, really, you know, one, certainly the test case that it provides, but also this is about Britain interceding in Canadian affairs. Canada, by this point, is on its course to become more independent.
Right.
It has a seemingly separate court system. So whether or not the British can impede on this from London, from Whitehall, and basically tell the Canadians what to rule or bring him back to London, as the question was, whether to use a writ of habeas corpus, bring him to London, try him there where he's going to get off, and keep him free. And the case winds up ending on a technicality, sort of fortunately for all of the various parties involved, but they're really trying to think about, okay, well, what does this mean in a real international sense? And it tests, and, you know, again, it gives the sense that, you know, this moral commitment is deep enough that they're willing to potentially go to the ends and intercede in Canada. Lawyers are very relieved that this doesn't become the precedent. And of course, in this particular venue, the American Civil War breaking out within months means right. that they don't have to look further than this. But what it raises for me, looking forward, and then I want to look backward, I guess, as well. But looking forward, it raises for me a question of what happens when these refugees, here, refugee slave, has blood on his or her hands, right? They always have. But what blood is palatable, right? Romantic revolutionaries on one hand, but then we're going to get very shortly to the anarchists
right.
and certainly others who the British don't want to concede are refugees or could be refugees, the Irish Fenians, right? So this raises a very uncomfortable family of resemblances in how people think about what refuge is and how it can be safeguarded, which gets me later into the question as they sort of back into this question of right. And to what extent refuge is a right itself. And here they're sort of circling around it as this either national and also imperial tradition and right. But they're not quite sure whether it's a tradition or a right. They're working this out. And soon they're going to get into the question of right more fully. But looking backwards, what happens to Anderson is quite interesting. He rarely talks in his account. These are all abolitionists who are talking for him.
Okay.
Very quickly, they get him to London so that they can safeguard him from another attempt to bring him back to the States. And they find that, you know, it becomes better for him to not be distracted by London. So he's removed to a more rural area. And eventually he's sent to Liberia because, of course, he's American. He's not, they think that he'll be a great leader of Liberia. So this is a great fanfare around providing him with a longer term home offshore.
Yes.
And we don't know the degree to which this was his own choice or not, but this was the high hope. So again, back to this question of long-term, certainly offshore's refuge and offshore's provision of a new life, you know, seems to be sort of the way forward still. Mm-hmm. And this is despite, or actually even in the face of ongoing difficulties by the 1850s and 60s in Sierra Leone, a point at which they start talking about Liberia a little bit more than they're talking about Sierra Leone.
Right, right. And this has a very clear parallel to what happens with a lot of abolitionists who, once actually in contact with a number of former slaves, have this real sense of disappointment. They sort of quickly try to separate them. There's a case in Jamaica during apprenticeship, James Williams, who was taken to London and is very quickly sent back to Jamaica, where he then, of course, disappears from the record. So there's this sort of interesting parallel there, not just of refuge, but also the interplay between refugee relief and abolitionist liberalism in a certain way.
Right. And I think one of the main differences, because I think you're absolutely right, that this is, and I follow very much on a Catherine Hall sort mm-hmm. of story of what happens in the wake of abolitionism, is that whereas you see a turn to demonizing, re-demonizing, sort of questioning the whole project of abolitionism among people in Britain, you know, around, you know, Carlyle, Dickens, et cetera, around Warren Hay later on, refugees are still this slightly different category that both fit and become problematic because that's a whole discussion happening. Refugees fleeing persecution are meant to automatically be more deserving, right?
Right.
So, and more heroic and more self-aware, right? So this is a way in which you start to see distinctions that they start to draw in odd ways between fugitive slaves, people who've run actively, and liberated Africans who have just been freed passively.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that same language of the time, trying to parse out what this means. But certainly there's a sense that that refugee thing is something distinct, even though their actions in providing refuge don't necessarily keep it as distinct as it should be.
Right.
Or as it could, it might have been.
Right. So the Anderson case, I think, provides us a really interesting segue into the final phase that you're tracking here. And that is the legal enshrinement of a right to refuge that is happening at the same time that these concerns about, what, as you phrase it, how much blood these people have on their hands, also, are emerging. And they're emerging, you note, in particular as the radical politics become, the radical politics in the British Isles and in the continent, become much more violent, more anarchist movements, the Fenians. So can you talk about the 1870 Extradition Act, how in fact that ties to refugee relief, and the ways that, you know, up until this point, you note that there hasn't really been any attempt to enshrine this legally, and now there is. So if you could walk us through this.
Right. I love the 1870 Act and the triumph, the momentary triumph that it seems to bring with it. Yeah, so the 1870 Extradition Act, there have been other extradition acts before that don't have the clause that I'm about to talk about here, and that becomes a problem, for instance, in the Anderson case. So the clause that the Extradition Act is about getting frauds back to try them, to deal with the ease by which criminals of all sorts can flee abroad. So an attempt to regulate that as extradition now is. The clause that they put into the 1870 Act very triumphantly as a protection clause that those who are fleeing persecution, so for political reasons, basically, are exempted from this. So it's a political offender exemption clause, basically. And what this means is that refugees who have blood on their hands are exempted from this. So an Anderson or a Garibaldi can still flee. But there's, of course, a question that this brings up simultaneously. And that, as you gestured to, is about the changes on the ground that have been there for a while in many respects, but are really coming to the fore with the rise of Irish Fenianism, continental communism. So this is happening almost at the same moment as the Paris Commune. It happens within months of this bill's passage. So the question is, okay, what constitutes a political offense? Is it something that can happen only in the light of day, i.e. with an open civil war? Or is this something like, can an assassin, you know, be safeguarded? And the British are very nervous. So this is a way in which, and you know, I think in different ways, this chapter in particular, but the other chapters also get at is the way they sort of back into this category of safety, of a refuge, or essentially creating a category for a refugee and space for a refugee to have safety in Britain or with any of these places that they're signing the extradition treaties with, that this is happening just as they really don't want to do it. And they're sort of backing into this, right? They do it triumphantly in 1870, but they're very quickly trying to figure out how they can amend it to narrow that space in which, you know, sometimes they're thinking about it in terms of, well, we want to be able to get our Irish Fenians back to try them, but we don't want to have to give you your continental revolutionaries, because we actually do, after a lot of debate, decide that the French communards are actually political refugees. right? We're not sure at first, but you know, they have a political program. They're political refugees. And this opens a big space, and a big international space in which, while Britain's leading the way in terms of creating this exemption clause, it's also the first to start to try to scale back. And that's a lot of what this, especially this last portion of the book, winds up being about, is about how do we both recognize the power, the moral and the international power of this category that we've created and that we've championed for so long, with our real unwillingness in different ways. And here it's politically and in terms of the types of refugees, elsewhere it's in terms of resources and space. How do we grapple with what this means?
Right.
And in a way, though this is a triumphant moment for a category and the humanitarianism that they've been pioneering, they're really undercutting it and stepping back out of the scene from this moment forward.
So along these lines, you note two specific cases in which we see a real attempt to narrow the category of refugee, and particularly sort of going back to these lines of, or in one case, going back to trying to parse the distinction between between a persecuted foreigner and simply a poor or indigent immigrant. And so I'll ask you to talk about these two instances in turn. The first being fugitive slaves, not out of the Americas, but fugitive slaves in East Africa. So here we're talking about the Indian Ocean, where there's sort of a really different set of geopolitical concerns for Britain. So I'll ask you to talk about that. And then next, or finally, the refugees, the Jewish refugees from the Eastern European pogroms, and culminating with the sort of, with the 1905 Aliens Act. And I think here you're really, again, sort of almost going full circle in this way of really parsing out who is actually a persecuted foreigner and what level of persecution is required. So if you could take those in turn.
Yeah, and I think I would say generally that this question of who's a persecuted foreigner is consistent throughout. So in a way, it's, you know, it's full circle in terms of the, but also at the same time, it's a dynamic that I think goes on in most refugee crises within themselves as well. As, you know, I think the fugitive slave case, East Africa one as well. So the context for the question of asylum for fugitive slaves in East Africa is a moment in which, and this is 1876, it's a moment before the British have taken over East Africa by the Imperial British East Africa Company, and then, you know, as formal colonies. So, you know, so this is a moment prior to that takeover, just to situate that in a moment. And it's a moment in which they're still, as, you know, had been the case and it would continue to be the case, trying to make spaces for trade, trying to ease relationships on the ground. They don't want to irritate the, you know, certainly the Sultan of Zanzibar, you know, so the leadership in the region. And certainly one way of doing that fairly quickly is providing refuge to all the legal slaves who are working in the Arab pearl fisheries, in particular along the coast. So the setup is the British are there patrolling for the illegal slave traffic. They, however, think, and they have a few instances in which this is happening already, but they're worried that en masse legal slaves, legal domestic slaves who are not being trafficked, but who are nonetheless near or on the water, are going to try to flee to British ships for safety and claim protection. So this is more out of fear that the numbers are going to be there, but there are a couple of instances of this actually happening. So the question becomes, okay, well, what do we do? And this is, again, a way in which they're trying to figure out, okay, what constitutes persecution? And they do so in a couple of interesting ways in this moment that are both expected by probably by this point in the book, but also unexpected as well. The first expected way is that they try to figure out, okay, well, what are they facing? What are they facing at home? Is this tantamount to persecution? And there's a notion at this point that domestic slavery in the Eastern context is quote unquote less bad than the plantation-based slavery of the Caribbean. Whatever you will on that score, they believe that they're, you know, that there's a rationale for thinking that this is not, they're not fleeing in hot blood. And if they are fleeing in hot blood, you know, sure, they can, you know, they can seek refuge, eventually what they decide in the circular. Or maybe not. And this gets into sort of what's sort of new in this case. This circular, which at first is trying to bar all, this is an Admiralty circular, trying to bar admission of all fugitive slaves on board British ships, classically brings the metropolitan public to arms again, not to rhetorical arms, claiming that this cannot happen, that this is contrary to everything that is British, both British in terms of anti-slavery and British in terms of refugees. The argument that the commission that gets up makes is on the one hand about the hot blood, not fleeing in hot blood, but also starts to question, okay, well, what is this refuge that we're providing? And for the first time, ironically, and this is used as a means of trying to scale back. So it's used against what would be the more humanitarian argument, but they're making the humanitarian argument, the moral argument. The refuge that we're providing in Aden, Bombay, the Seychelles more particularly, for these liberated Africans, liberated Africans and fugitive slaves together, is worse than slavery. And indeed, the conditions were appalling.
Right.
But they're making this argument to say that, okay, this is a reason why we should recommit ourselves to the eventual gradual abolition of slavery writ large, but we shouldn't be on board with the consolation prize that we've always gone with, that this broad hat refuge that we've been providing or could be providing is really not the way forward. So they're backpedaling at the same moment as they're trying to define it. So the result is this is somewhat ad hoc, you know, this sort of admission that British refuge, especially in the colonies or, you know, and further afield, is not great. But a question of for whom that should be a barrier to entry,
right,
in itself, as a reason to either renege on or fully celebrate that category. But it's not a category in the end that they're willing to jettison, even though they're trying to whittle away who can be involved in it.
So the moral commitment is still remaining strong, even at the same time that they're narrowing the category.
Right. Well, it's what they're hedging on is the definition of persecution.
Sure. Sure.
Persecution is the ultimate trump card, and remains so, and will remain so through. I know we're going to get to the Aliens Act later. Will remain so in the sort of a clause within the Aliens Act as well. But at the same time, they are really working to narrow what that looks like, and in a way, there is a universalism still inherent in the potential of who could be persecuted. But in practice, what they're doing is essentially, in this case of East Africa, saying, okay, well, it doesn't suffice to just be a slave.
Right.
In a way that they hadn't done before.
Right. So if we can shift to the refugees from the Eastern European pogroms, and this is the final chapter of the book. First, if I may ask, why, because I think this is an interesting shift in the text, why the shift to this particular group for the sort of final case of the book?
Right. In a way, because this is where the literature that we have on refugees begins.
Okay.
And immigration to Britain. So if there's a much longer story of it, it's that the British, who in the construct of much of the scholarship to date, has not really cared much about the foreigners in the midst and doesn't really do the sorts of careful stuff of parsing through who's a refugee and what that means, you know, before this point. Starts to care, and they start to care in a negative sense, according to this literature, because, of course, the Aliens Act of 1905 bars entry for the first time to the UK for the terms of the act bar those who don't have more than £5 in their possession. at the time of entry. So it's essentially geared to eliminate the arrival of destitute foreigners who at this point are Eastern European Jews. So in a way, it's because of that, but I think this moment that I start here, or end here, I should say, but also because this is a much broader story as well than just the British Isles. So in a way, it enables me to bring a lot of my threads together once more, that being the need for places for transmigration, the degree to which British refugees come to rely on that, and ultimately sort of the preservation of some category of refuge who, for those who are truly persecuted, at the same time as they are continuing to sort of whittle away what that might mean. So in terms of the international, this is a moment in which, so as increasingly Eastern European Jews are coming to Britain as well as elsewhere in Western Europe, increasingly from 1880, places like America, Canada, South Africa, Australia, places that have been classic points of transmigration for refugees who come through Britain, are starting to close their own doors. And the British colony, I guess I was thinking about Canada, South Africa, Australia, at this point are controlling their own policy in this respect. So, you know, unlike with Canada, with Anderson, the British are not going to, you know, intercede on that score. They're closing those places are closing their doors to these asylum seekers, basically. Because there is no place to go,
right?
My argument in this argument in this chapter, it really draws all the more attention to ultimately the East End of London,
mm-hmm.
which is part of the broader story that we do know from the other literature, especially on the Anglo-Jewry and on foreigners in Britain, more particularly that the arguments that these foreigners in particular are a too foreign, leading into an anti-Semitism that's been on the ground. Again, a lot of that in the past had been mitigated by transmigration in terms of other refugee groups, is increasingly there. Worry about competition, worry about what this is doing to the rents in the East End, the arrival of sweatshops. This is caught up in a story of changes in the economy and economic competition here. Because of this, the aliens debates really get going. And so it's a question of, and this is why ultimately in the Aliens Act, despite a lot of liberal disapproval, they wind up barring this. There's a lot of question about, okay, how much competition are they really providing? Are they a benefit? Or, you know, have other immigrants groups and refugee groups been a benefit to British society before or not? A lot of this comes in. What comes in more particularly for me that I'm really interested in is the question of persecution again.
Right.
They have a big debate in terms of talking about, okay, well, again, who is a refugee? And who is a refugee? They start to articulate here in the negative that somebody fleeing for a better life, essentially economic persecution or, you know, sort of economic opportunity, as they say it in Britain, cannot constitute a refugee.
Right.
And here's where they're going. They go into a lot of detail about, okay, well, there are other minority groups persecuted in the Russian Empire. There are other people better equipped than we are to provide refuge. You know, a number of reasons that are, again, rationalizing the narrowing of this category, potentially the passage of this bill as a whole. The bill as a whole, though, does still wind up unable to really undo that core piece about persecution. And despite its you know, extremely harsh decisions about who can come in, does wind up preserving a refugee category. Those who flee for fear of life or limb, so here's the hot blood portion mm-hmm. again, can, you know, need to be provided with asylum, right? They're not going to be returned or denied entry. So here what we have here, and we have this both in We have this in the Extradition Act. We have this in the Fugitive Slave, the circulars of the 1876 in East Africa, and again in the Aliens Act, this real ultimate right to refuge that they're articulating.
Mm-hmm.
We're an increasingly small, you know, they're trying to whittle it down, but it's a right, and it's codified in a way that you know, even today, we don't have codified. It gets undone very quickly.
Right.
We have this codification of it that is, I think, something, you know, really to celebrate while recognizing, of course, all of the attendant debates and attempts at backpedaling that happen along with it.
Right. So as we begin to wrap up, there are two questions about the sort of broader impact of the project that I want to talk about. You've gestured towards the literature on humanitarianism, the literature on human rights. Can you speak to how your work fits in into that literature?
Certainly. I think the big piece, I often use the term humanitarianism and universal humanitarianism as opposed to right, which I talk about in the latter portion of the book. But I think it's in dialogue very much with both of them. What my hope is to show the degree to which these two are, especially in the case of refugees, very related. The question of what commitments take shape, how they take shape, humanitarian story, and the language of the discussion of what is a right and how universal that can be, very quickly attend to it. In terms of the literature on human rights, we tend to be very 20th century focused, increasingly talking about the interwar era, but really it's, you know, sort of post 45, and that there's this handoff between an earlier humanitarianism and a later human rights discussion. And in human rights, some people talk about it in the 18th century as well, but there's, you know, does it start there and then sort of skip over the period of empire? What happens here? And I think one of my big hopes is that this really starts our discussion about these categories of rights and discussions of universals that we talk about when we talk about human rights, putting that back into the story of the 19th century, of empire, of humanitarian commitments. I think in terms of humanitarianism, we tend, although this has been sort of an oversight that's been remedied by others as well more recently, that we tend to talk about various categories of sort of our own, be they colonial subjects, be they our own slaves, you know, be they our own citizens. And I think that's one of the reasons why human rights literature says, oh, well, okay, in the 19th century, they're always talking about their own in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about this broader category of universal and everything. And I think refugees forces that conversation about foreigners, about a broader category of people who are, you know, certainly people that the British identify with for various reasons, be that, you know, sort of emerging liberal discussions of what to be liberal means and what British, you know, global commitments are being made and sort of thought out. But I think that this story brings that out more.
Right.
In a way, refugees inherently have to draw out these connections in a way that we haven't really done too much of.
Right. Thank you for that. So we have, for the most part, avoided in this discussion talking about the contemporary moment. But of course, this book came out in October 2015, right at the heart of these debates over Syrian refugees. And I think one of the things that was striking to me as I was reading the book is the way that the moral commitment in this British case seems to remain pretty firm. And I was reading this at a moment in which at least the American moral commitment seems to be wavering, not sure it exists at all. So what insights do you think your book or the way that you're talking about refugee relief, what insights might this have on the current moment, particularly with the Syrian refugee crisis?
Mm-hmm. I think I'll speak more locally than sort of move out.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the British commitment, I think there's a lot of hand waving at this past. And this hand waving to a firm commitment to refugees and that past has been more on the side of a conservative right, that look, we've done all of this in the past. You know, we don't have to do it now. Or, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, let's sort of, you know, we stand for this, right? Even if the actions are not always, you know, sort of standing up with that. I think in that respect, my work alongside somebody like Tony Kushner's work, who looks at the difficulties in British memory of refugees starting from a 20th century standpoint, but he starts with the Jews and goes back to the Huguenots, sort of jumping over the middle of the 19th century, but you know, sort of speaking well to the fact that these were, you know, there were refugees who came in, but they didn't have it very good. I think my intervention here is, and my hope is that to show that there was much more of a conversation going on, that certainly there was a commitment to refuge, and that is something to be celebrated, but it's something that needs to be continually done, right? That this is something that was always in and out of the public eye, and when it was out of the public eye, it led to a lot of assumptions of how it was being done well that mm-hmm. didn't stand up to reality. And I think the same thing, you know, from 1905 forward, that, you know, the moment there is an enshrined right in the Aliens Act, people think, okay, well, it's enshrined, it's safeguarded, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that's not true either. And of course we know that today, that we need constant supervision, be that of the detention centers that are set up in the asylum seeking process, be that of the ongoing need to have these conversations. And I think that's one of the points that both locally and more broadly that I hope this makes, that the enshrining of right is not the end story. It's right. In a way that got backed into and, you know, needs to be remembered well, to be improved upon. The other piece that I've noticed a lot of discussion of in the press more recently in Britain, but broadly, is a discussion of where Syrians, more particularly these days, where they ought to be provided with refuge and how they could be better provided in different places. This is a way in which it's very interesting. On the very well-meaning refugee support side, there's a lot of talk about, well, they'll be better served in Jordan, or we, you know, this is not the right place. And I want to highlight with that smacks of a lot of the attempts in the 19th century, certainly a bit of the 18th century, and certainly we haven't talked about it, but elsewhere in the 20th century too, right, outside the parameters of this particular book, that the attempt to find empty space where refugees are going to be better served. And, you know, we're certainly not at a point today where we can forego any options to help with the migrant crisis and to help people who are seeking refuge anywhere. So I wouldn't say, okay, don't take Jordan off the table, but recognize that there's a degree often of trying to excuse oneself. And even if the people who are touting these other alternatives aren't actually saying that, there's a sense of, okay, well, they're better served elsewhere, so we can sort of step back, or we can step up in a particular way, but not deal with the harder questions about integration, the harder questions about welcoming people in our own midst. And I think the 19th century story sets that up well, and I think there are a lot of echoes of it today too.
That's absolutely fascinating, and certainly much much needed a point of view as we continue to grapple with the Syrian refugee crisis. So, Caroline, I want to thank you for speaking with us today. And we generally ask one final question, which is, what are you working on now?
Oops, you've cut out.
Oh, have I?
I am starting on a new project that looks at the legal defenses of reputation. And broadly, I'm thinking of it as a social history of the defense of reputation. And it is, yes, sort of starting with a fairly familiar question to me, given that I've been working in this gray area of a right to refuge for so long. Mm-hmm. But the question at the start, at the least, is there, you know, quite simply, is there a right to reputation? And it comes from two areas. It comes from certainly the observation that Britain has seemed to become this libel hub of at least Europe, if not the globe, and they've been trying to remedy this for decades now. And there's but then also a question about, okay, what is this relationship between freedom of the speech on the one hand and a very quickly safeguarded right to reputation, or right to not be demeaned within the eyes of your own community as well. So while people have been thinking a lot about right to freedom of expression, my question is, okay, well, what is this thing of particularly private reputation, personal reputation, as it gets damaged or potentially damaged, and how do people try to safeguard it?
That sounds fascinating. And we're certainly very much looking forward to that project. So again, Caroline, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you all for listening to the first episode of New Books in British Studies.
Thank you, Christina.
You've been listening to the first episode of New Books in British Studies. Thanks for joining us, and see you next time. Thank you.